welcome to the Penn Faulkner podcast. I'm Lily Meyer, Public Programs Coordinator of the Penn Faulkner Foundation, and I'm so excited to bring you a recent event with Celeste Ng and John Ray. Celeste Ng is the author of the wildly acclaimed debut novel, Everything I Never Told You, and John Ray is the winner of a Whiting Award at Guggenheim and more for his four novels, including most recently, The Lost Time Accident. Celeste and John joined us at the Folger Shakespeare Library in February 2016 to talk about menace in their work. And the evening was, as they both put it, a love fest. Enjoy the show.
Good evening, and welcome back to the Penn Faulkner Reading Series for our first event in 2016. My name is Emma Snyder. I know many of you, though not all. And as the executive director of the Penn Faulkner Foundation, it's my pleasure to welcome you here for Not Waving But Drowning, an evening with Celeste Ng and John Ray. Penn Faulkner can't present these readings alone, of course, so as always, I want to start by giving thanks to the Folger Shakespeare Library for providing us with such a spectacular home stage, which I think is even more spectacular than usual this time, and to Politics and Prose, our loyal bookselling best friends, who will have books by John and Celeste on sale during the post-reading reception. And on that note, tonight we're really lucky in that we get to enjoy the reception in the Folger's beautiful and usually cordoned off and very private reading room. So be sure to join us if you head out into the Great Hall and we're not there. Just hook a right and we'll be inside. Thanks also to the Penn Faulkner Board of Directors and specifically to our program committee chairs, Margaret Talbot and Dolan Perkins Valdez, who provide really thoughtful direction that leads to wonderful nights like tonight. And of course, to all of you. Tonight, you don't just reap the significant pleasures of the onstage reading and discussions that we'll get to hear, but you help to build a literary community here in the district. And so we thank you for that. And finally, it's my most sincere pleasure to thank Katie Waldman, Celeste Ng, and John Ray for being here tonight, John and Celeste for their beautiful novels, and also for their travel down to the district. Personally, I first encountered John Ray through his novel Low Boy, which, appropriately enough, I read on a metro here in D.C. many years ago. And then again with his just-released The Lost Time Accident. I met Celeste Ng through Everything I Never Told You just last year. They're books that imprinted on me for reasons that ranged from their sheer inventiveness to their mastery of shifting perspectives to the restraint they showed in handling traumatic circumstances. But what really affected me, and a number of us, I think, at Penn Faulkner, seemed to be a through line in their work, which was how both of these novelists approach the ways we live in the world as strangers to each other and to ourselves. Not always clear on how best we can ask for or answer calls toward help. The title of tonight's event is drawn from a short 1953 poem by a British poet named Stevie Smith. And I encourage everyone to read it. It's really short and really interesting. And as you might imagine, it describes a man who drowns. But death isn't the thing in the poem. Instead, it cuts to the quick of the life that preceded it. And it closes with the lines, "I was much too far out all my life, and not waving, but drowning." That poem and these novelists probe the territory of emotion and of perception that is liminal, and sometimes of time itself. It begs questions about how far we can go, and how long we can last, and who sees us, and what does it ever mean to be seen. They're questions that make for really amazing fiction and also for great conversation that we get to be the recipients of tonight. So Katie Waldman is here to lead us in that effort. A DC native, Katie is an assistant editor and the words correspondent at Slate, an insightful reader, a really great writer, and I think we're in excellent hands. So Katie.
Thanks. Should I go? I think I have a microphone affixed to my shoulder, so I'm not sure if I need to move. But thank you so much for that introduction, Emma. I'm really happy to be here and so thrilled to be in the company of these two writers who, over the past 2 weeks, I've been sort of immersing myself in and admiring. And I think it's going to be a really great conversation. I especially appreciate the way that their books talk about pressure and intimacy and sort of the reality of having an interior life and how you communicate that or don't. And so I am very excited to talk to you both. And I thought maybe we should start with some introductions. So Celeste Ng, is the author of Everything I Never Told You, a New York Times notable book and Amazon Best Book of the Year in 2014. It was also a New York Times bestseller and the recipient of multiple prizes, including the Massachusetts Book Award and the Asian Pacific American Award for Literature. Ng hails from a family of scientists. She grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Shaker Heights, Ohio, and earned her bachelor's degree from Harvard University. She went on to attend what is now the Helen Zell Writers Program at the University of Michigan, where she won the Hopwood Award. Her fiction and essays have appeared in One Story, Tri Quarterly, Bellevue Literary Review, the Kenyon Review Online, and elsewhere, and she is the recipient of the Pushcart Prize. Ng lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So that is Celeste Ng and John Ray. Sorry, I'm reading from a script so I don't leave anything out, but John Ray is the author of the novels The Right Hand of Sleep, which won a Whiting Writers Award, Canaan's Tongue, Low Boy, and most recently, The Lost Time Accidents. He's received a Guggenheim Fellowship and a Mary Ellen von der Hayden Fellowship from the American Academy in Berlin. Granta also named him one of the best young American novelists in 2007. Ray lives in New York City, where he contributes regularly to the New York Times Magazine. He is a citizen of both the United States and Austria. So welcome, Celeste and John. I would like to start actually with a fairly obvious observation, which is that both of you have written books that seem deeply interested in the fate and the perspective of outsiders. So we have Will Heller in Low Boy, who's isolated by mental illness, and Waldy Tolliver in The Lost Time Accidents, who is exiled from the flow of time itself, and Lydia Lee, who is a mixed-race teenager in 1970s Ohio, and also alienated, I think, by the existential condition of being 16 years old. And at the same time, we're learning also more about the people constellated around these characters, and the more we see about them, the parents, the investigators, the siblings, the more we realize that everyone sort of feels like an outsider, and no one quite feels that they belong. And so first, I guess I'd like to know what attracts you both to the feeling of loneliness or otherness as a literary subject, whether it's a sort of personal identification or an imaginative project, sort of projecting yourself into lives lived on the margins. But then second, to what extent you feel that these characters really are outsiders, or whether they just embody something more general about being a person in the world.
She doesn't mess around.
No. Straight for the jugular. You're asking us whether we had any friends growing up.
In so many words.
All right, I'll start. I guess for me, I think there's a difference, or there's a distinction to be drawn between being an outsider and being an outcast. Mm-hmm. I think that as humans, we're often really interested in the outliers, at least I find myself to be. We're always really interested in sort of the spectacular successes or the horrible failures. You know, people who live kind of ordinary lives, we don't tend to pay a lot of attention to, for better or for worse. And so I'm always sort of drawn to those extremes and to think about, well, how did you end up so far over here or over here? And so for me, I think it's less about loneliness and more sort of about the people who end up on their own, whether they choose to or not, and how, as you said, sort of how the people who are constellated around them can reach them or don't reach them. It's a pretty fundamental question about how well we can communicate with each other and how well we can understand each other, and I'm sort of fascinated by that that overlap.
Yeah, I think that's certainly very interesting, and it's a good point of departure a lot of the time. I also think that if you're interested in trying to describe a given environment or a given society or a given group of people of any size, really, the people who are in the middle of it all, often they don't always have the same perspective that an outsider might have. You know, someone who has one foot in and one foot out can often see things more clearly than maybe the people that are being observed. So if you're choosing a character to focus on, or if you're trying to select someone to be your narrator, and you're looking for someone who might have that useful perspective on a given situation or a given group, it's often that sort of borderline outsider who can provide that.
I mean, that's really fascinating, because it does seem that there's a link in both of your novels between vision and not loneliness, but sort of alienness or otherness. And it also seems that there are sort of two modes of looking that are happening. There's kind of the looking that you do when you notice someone's different from you or on the outside, and you gawk and laugh, and especially I think Lydia deals with that a lot in Everything I Never Told You. But then there's the kind of looking that's sort of seeing and appreciating and connecting with perhaps the vision of the camera, which also plays a role in your book as a sort of neutral midpoint where you don't necessarily understand, but you don't necessarily feel alienated. And I wonder if both of your books can sort of be seen as these crisscrossing gazes, like how do you think about what it means to see a character and what it means for characters to see each other?
I like the distinction that you made between sort of looking or maybe noticing and then seeing someone, because I think in seeing, we're sort of implying a certain amount of understanding or a certain amount of accuracy in perceiving. And those two things aren't necessarily the same, and I think that's a lot of sort of what I was trying to wrestle with in the novel, is that everyone in the novel sort of wants to be seen, and that they're kind of getting a little bit overlooked. You know, there's a mother who is sort of frustrated in her ambitions, and she's sort of frustrated that she's perceived to be a housewife, but she feels that she's more. And so likewise with Lydia, the main character, she sees how her parents want her to be, and yet she perceives herself to be something different. And so that's sort of, I guess that it relates to your first question about being sort of inside and outside, about how, whether that membrane between the two can ever really be permeated. Mm-hmm.
I think for me, when you were asking the question, I was thinking of it, it's funny, and exactly the kind of complement to that, which is the way the characters themselves are seeing their environment and their surroundings. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I'm often drawn to characters, at least as protagonists or narrators, who are kind of mesmerized, but also a bit bewildered by the world around them. And part of the kind of arc that they have within the book is often at least they're attempting to arrive at an understanding of events that are confusing or bewildering to them. Which I guess we all are all the time, or maybe just speaking for myself.
I think that's right, though. I mean, I think, at least for me, but maybe for many other writers, we're sort of drawn to, like you were saying, trying to make sense out of what's going on. I mean, I think what you said, that part of the magic of Lo Boy is that there's this character who sees things in a very different way than other people do. And part of our joy as readers is kind of starting to understand how he is seeing things. And that's a pretty big feat, and that's a feat that I think really fiction is unique in kind of capturing, in putting you inside somebody else's head and getting you to think their thoughts. There's not a lot of other ways that we can kind of approach that experience, and I think that's sort of one of the fundamental magic parts of fiction.
Yeah, and especially because the project of fiction is not just reading or seeing, but also interpreting, which gets back to Lo Boy, and William is so fascinating for the really inventive and strange and counterintuitive ways that he interprets what would seem like a random fact to us. And there's kind of this sense of sort of invisible systems and sort of so seeming random details in conspiracy that made me think that William's mind is not unlike a novelist's mind, like someone who builds a world, creates a world. And so I was wondering, did you feel an affinity for this character when you were building that world?
I feel like this is another trick question.
Sorry. I was actually
I'm
sent
not
here
insane.
By a therapist.
No, of course I did. And you have to, I think you have to, if you don't begin with an affinity for the characters you're writing, both the more likable characters and the more despicable characters, you certainly have to arrive at an affinity for them in the course of writing them, or else you're going to end up with cardboard cutouts, really. But in writing that book, if I can remember that far back, I did find it interesting in trying to educate myself about schizophrenia, the degree of creativity that seemed to go into the kind of world building that some sufferers from schizophrenia do. You know, I mean, they do create these elaborate systems by which to understand phenomena that are terrifying to them, and a world that they have a hard time interpreting often, and that doesn't understand them either. And in The Lost Time Accidents, it's actually quite similar, since both books deal with mental illness to some degree, but in a different way. But I think again, that's something that sort of makes a human being interesting is the creative ways in which he or she has found to interpret the world around them, because it's something that we learn to some degree, and it's something that we then add to and create for ourselves. Not much of it is innate. You know, we kind of learn how to understand the world, and some of us go horribly wrong in that understanding, and those people are fun to write about for whatever reason.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Maybe we should hear some of this work, these beautiful words. So would you like to start, Celeste?
We had a discussion backstage about who was going first.
I won.
He's taller. We haven't talked much about sort of the plot of the novel, so I'll give you a very sort of brief plot introduction, and then I'll just read a short section. The novel, as Katie said, takes place in Ohio in the 1970s, and it focuses on the Lee family. They're a mixed-race Chinese and white family. The father is a Chinese-American, and the mother is a white woman from Virginia. And they have three children. And when the novel opens, Lydia, who is the middle child, who's 16 and who's the favorite in the family, is not in her bed. And the family soon finds out that she's drowned in the neighborhood lake. And this sort of opens up a lot of secrets that the family has been, things that the family has not been discussing. So that's the sort of opening of the book. There's a mystery that propels the story, but it's really a lot about family dynamics and communications and the things that we don't talk about even with the people that we're closest to. So as with any tragedy, the roots of it generally go back a lot farther than we tend to think they do. So for tonight's section, I'm going to read you a little section about how the parents met each other. Marilyn is the mother. She grew up, as I said, in Virginia, and she's, at the time they meet, she's a student at Radcliffe. And James, who's the father in the family, is a first-generation Chinese-American, and he's a grad student. So I think that's all you need to know about how the two parents come together. It was September 1957, her junior year, at the back of a crowded lecture hall. Cambridge was still sweltering and sticky, and everyone was waiting for the crisp cool of fall to sweep the city clean. The course was new that year, the cowboy in American culture, and everyone wanted to take it. Rumor had it their homework would be watching The Lone Ranger and Gunsmoke on television. Marilyn took a piece of loose leaf from her folder, and while her head was bent, quiet fell over the room like snow. She glanced up at the professor approaching the podium, and then she understood why everyone had gone silent. The course catalog had listed the instructor as James P. Lee. He was a fourth-year graduate student, and no one knew anything about him. To Marilyn, who had spent all her years in Virginia, Lee conjured a certain kind of man, a Richard Henry, a Robert E. Now she realized that she, that everyone, had expected someone in a sand-colored blazer, someone with a slight drawl and a southern pedigree. The man setting his papers on the lectern was youngish and thin, but that was as close as he came to what they had all pictured. An Oriental, she thought. She'd never seen one in person before. He was dressed like an undertaker, black suit, black tie knotted tight, shirt so white it glowed. His hair was slicked back and parted in a perfect pale line, but one wisp stood straight up and back. As he started to speak, he reached up with one hand to smooth down the cowlick, and someone snickered. If Professor Lee heard, he didn't show it. "Good afternoon," he said. Marilyn found herself holding her breath as he wrote his name on the board. She could see them through her classmates' eyes, and she knew what they were thinking. This was their professor? This little man, 5'9" at the most, and not even American, was going to teach them about cowboys? But when she studied him again, she noticed how slender his neck was, how smooth his cheeks. He looked like a little boy playing dress-up, and she closed her eyes and prayed for the class to go well. The silence stretched, taut as the surface of a bubble, ready to be popped. Someone shoved a sheaf of mimeograph syllabi over her shoulder, and she jumped. By the time she had taken the top copy and passed the rest on, Professor Lee had begun to speak again. "The image of the cowboy," he said, "has existed longer than we might imagine." There was no trace of an accent in his voice, and she slowly let out her breath. Where had he come from, she wondered. He sounded nothing like what she'd been told Chinamen sounded like. Had he grown up in America? 10 minutes in, the room began to rustle and murmur. Marilyn glanced at the notes she jotted down, phrases like, "undergone multiple evolutions in each era of American history," and "apparent dichotomy between social rebel and embodiment of quintessential American values." She scanned the syllabus. 10 required books, a midterm exam, 3 essays. This wasn't what her classmates had in mind. A girl at the side of the room tucked her book beneath her arm and slipped out the door. 2 girls from the next row followed. After that, it was a slow but steady trickle. Every minute or two, another few students left. One boy from the first row stood up and cut right in front of the podium on the way out. The last to leave were 3 boys from the back. They whispered and sniggered as they edged past just emptied seats, their thighs bumping each armrest with a soft thump, thump, thump. As the door closed behind them, Marilyn heard one shout, "Yippee-ki-yay!" so loud that he drowned out the lecture. Only 9 other students still remained, all studiously bent over notebooks, but they were all reddening in the cheeks and at the edges of their ears. Her own face was hot, and she didn't dare look at Professor Lee. Instead, she turned her face to her notes and put her hand to her forehead, as if shielding her eyes from the sun. When she finally peeked out at the podium again, Professor Lee gazed out over the room as if nothing were amiss. He didn't seem to notice that his voice now echoed in the nearly empty hall. He finished his lecture with 5 minutes remaining in the period and said, "I'll hold office hours until 3:00. For just a few seconds, he stared straight ahead, toward a distant horizon, and she squirmed in her seat as if he were staring directly at her. It was that last moment, the tingle at the back of her neck as he stacked his notes and left the room, that brought her to his office after the lecture. The history department had the peaceful quiet of a library, the air still and cool and slightly dusty. She found him at his desk, head propped against the wall, reading that morning's Crimson. The part in his hair had blurred and the cowlick stuck up again. "Professor Lee, I'm Marilyn Walker. I was in your lecture just now." Though she hadn't meant it to, the end of her voice swerved up into a question, and she thought, "I must sound like a teenage girl, a stupid, silly, shallow teenage girl." "Yes?" He did not look up, and Marilyn fiddled with the top button of her sweater. "I just wanted to check," she said, "if you thought I'd be able to keep up with the classwork." He still didn't look up. "Are you a history major?" "No, physics." "Senior?" "No, a junior. I'm going to medical school, so history, it's not my field." "Well," he said, "to be honest, I don't think you'll have any problems, if you choose to stay in the course, that is." He half-folded the newspaper, revealing a mug of coffee, took a sip, then fanned the paper out again. Marilyn pursed her lips. She understood that her audience was now over, that she was expected to turn around and walk back into the hallway and leave him alone. Still, she'd come here for something, though she wasn't sure what, and she jutted out her jaw and pulled a chair up to his desk. "Was history your favorite subject in school?" "Miss Walker," he said, looking up at last, "why are you here?" When she saw his face up close, just a table width away, she saw again how young he was. Maybe only a few years older than she was, Not even 30, she thought. His hands were broad, the fingers long. No rings. I just wanted to apologize for those boys, she said suddenly, and realized this was really why she'd come. He paused, eyebrows slightly raised, and she heard what he'd just heard. Boy, a trivializing word. Boys will be boys. Friends of yours? No, Marilyn said, stung. No, just idiots. At that, he laughed, and she did too. She watched tiny crinkles form around the corners of his eyes, and when they unfolded, his face was different, softer, a real person's face now. From here, she saw that his eyes were brown, not black, as they'd seemed in the lecture hall. How skinny he was, she thought, how wide his shoulders were, like a swimmer's. She had never seen anyone like him. I guess that sort of thing must happen all the time, she said softly. I wouldn't know. That was my first lecture. The department let me take this class as a trial. I'm sorry. It's all right, he said. You stayed until the end. They both looked down, he at his now empty mug, she at the typewriter and neat sheaf of carbon paper perched at the end of his desk. Paleontology, he said after a moment. What? Paleontology, he repeated. My favorite subject. It was paleontology. I wanted to dig up fossils. That's a kind of history, she said. I guess it is. He grinned into his coffee cup, and Marilyn leaned across the desk and kissed him. At Thanksgiving, Marilyn decided not to go home to Virginia. She told herself and James that it was too far for such a short holiday, but in reality, she knew her mother would ask her again if she had any prospects, and this time she did not know how to respond. Instead, in James's tiny kitchen, she roasted a chicken, cubed potatoes, peeled yams into a casserole dish the size of a steno pad, Thanksgiving dinner in miniature. James, who had never cooked himself a meal, who subsisted on burgers from Charlie's Kitchen and English muffins from the Hayes Bickford, watched in awe. After Marilyn basted the chicken, she looked up defiantly, closed the oven, and peeled the oven mitts from her hands. My mother is a home economics teacher, she said. Betty Crocker is her personal goddess. It was the first thing she had told him about her mother. The way she said it, it sounded like a secret, something she had kept hidden and now deliberately, trustingly revealed. James felt he should return this privilege, this private gift. He had mentioned once, in passing, that his parents had worked at a school, leaving it at that, hoping she'd think teacher. But he had never told her how the school kitchen had been like the land of the giants, everything economy-sized, rolls of tinfoil half a mile long, jars of mayonnaise big enough to hold his head. As a kitchen lady, his mother was in charge of bringing the world down to scale, chopping melons into dice-sized cubes, portioning pats of butter onto saucers to accompany each roll. He'd never told anyone how the other kitchen ladies snickered at his mother for wrapping up the leftover food instead of throwing it away. How at home, they'd reheat it in the oven while his parents quizzed him. What did you do in geography? What did you do in math? And he'd recite, Montgomery is the capital of Alabama. Prime numbers have only two factors. They didn't understand his answers, but they'd nodded, pleased that James was learning things they did not know. In the fifth grade, he had stopped speaking Chinese to his parents, afraid of tinting his English with an accent. Long before that, he had stopped speaking to his parents at school at all. He was afraid to tell Marilyn these things, afraid that once he admitted them, she would see him as he had always seen himself, a scrawny outcast, feeding on scraps, reciting his lines and trying to pass, an imposter. He was afraid she would never see him any other way. My parents are both dead, he said. They died just after I started college. His mother had died his second year, a tumor blossoming in her brain. His father had gone 6 months later. Complications of pneumonia, the doctors had said, but James had known the truth. His father simply hadn't wanted to live alone. Marilyn didn't say anything, but she reached out and cupped his face in her hands, and James felt the leftover heat from the oven in her soft palms. They were there only a moment before the timer buzzed and she turned back to the stove, but they warmed him through. He remembered his mother's hands, scarred from steam burns, calloused from scouring pots, and wanted to press his lips to the tender hollow where Marilyn's lifeline and love line crossed. He promised himself he would never let those hands harden. As Marilyn took the chicken, burnished and bronze, from the oven, he was mesmerized by her deftness. It was beautiful, the way broth thickened to gravy under her guidance, how potatoes fluffed like cotton beneath her fork. This was the closest thing he'd seen to magic. A few months later, when they married, they would make a pact to let the past drift away, to stop asking questions, to look forward from then on, never back. Thank you.
Pretty great.
I think it's your turn.
Oh, it's my turn. I thought we were going to chat about Celeste's book a little bit.
I mean, we could. We can go for it. You're standing.
All right.
You're already.
I'm, now
you're
that
already
I'm here. So I'm not going to be reading from Low Boy, which was my book before my most recent book. I'm going to be reading from this book, which just came out last week. It's a novel called The Lost Time Accidents, and there's a lot of stuff I could explain, but I don't think that I have to. It's essentially 100 years in the life of a family, about 3.5 generations in the life of that family, and the family begins, the story begins in what's now the Czech Republic, in Moravia, and in the course of the 20th century, this family emigrates first to Vienna, then via Italy to New York City in the United States, and then sort of spread out. So it's in a little bit, it's in a certain way, it's an immigrant story, I suppose. But what distinguishes this particular family is that they have a very particular and eccentric relationship to consensus reality, as they like to call it. And they each believe in their own sort of idiosyncratic ways that they have a unique understanding of, and in some cases an influence over the passage of time. On June the 12th, 1903, 2 hours and 45 minutes before being killed by a virtually stationary motor car, my great-grandfather made a discovery that promised to shake the world to its foundations. Ottokar Gottfriedens Tulla, father of two, amateur physicist, pickler by trade, had spent the morning in his laboratory, a converted brining room directly beneath the main square of Znojmo, Moravia, the Gherkin capital of the Habsburg Empire, and was about to lock up for the afternoon when something about the arrangement of objects on a workbench caught his eye. According to his notes, he spent the better part of a quarter hour perfectly motionless, his right hand still cradling his keys, staring over his left shoulder at the spatial dynamics, as he put it, between a crucible, a brining jar, and a slowly desiccating winter pear. A jarring, insistent noise, which he eventually identified as the jangling of his key ring, brought him out of his bedazzlement, and he approached the workbench with a trembling step. By the time he'd cleared a space on his perennially cluttered desk, pinched his pince-nez into place, and dug his notebook out from under a heap of cherry pits, the first crude attempt at a theory was already coalescing in his brain. He lowered himself to the bench, taking great care not to tip it over, and in less than an hour wrote the entry, 7 pages of tilting script that would trouble the dreams of his descendants for the next 100 years. I couldn't possibly know this, not all of it, but I hope you'll indulge me a little. Ottokar's notes, the sole source I have for this scene, are as dry as pencil shavings. The only means I've got to bring this primal scene to life is the license I've given myself to speculate. Imagination is a form of time travel, after all, however bumbling and incomplete, and every history is an act of subterfuge. The town my great-grandfather lived and died in
Znaim to the Germanic ruling class, Znoimo to the Czechs, was a pretty imperial backwater, prosperous and unpretentious, known for its views of the DJ River, its pickling mills, and not a thing besides. A postcard from the year of Ottokar's death combines these twin distinctions into a single tidy package. Entitled A Visit to Znaim, it depicts a portly businessman in a bowler hat, happily suspended in midair above the DJ River, with the town square glowing rosily in the background. Pickles peek out of his pockets, and he brandishes a brining brush in his right hand like a riding crop. His flight seems to have been made possible by the gargantuan, midnight green, unapologetically phallic gherkin that he straddles like some suicidal gaucho. A poem at the bottom left-hand corner does nothing whatsoever to explain this situation, though it does strike me as pertinent to my great-grandfather's brief, quixotic life. A gherkin from the land of Znaim is mightier than the hand of time. Its savory brine, at first so sour, grows sweeter with each passing hour. Znoimo's only other claim to a place in history, oddly enough, is even more closely aligned with poor Ottokar's fate. From 1716 until 1719, the town was home to Václav Prokop Divis, an otherwise unassuming Catholic priest who had the spectacularly bad luck of inventing the lightning rod at the same time as Benjamin Franklin. Divis died a pauper's death in a Moravian monastery, forgotten by the scientific world. Franklin got his fat face on the $100 bill. There's a lesson in that, about the disadvantages of being Czech, if nothing else, but my great-grandfather opted to ignore it. By his own account, Ottokar was 6'4", 183 pounds, and of 49 years duration at the time of his demise. He'd have stood out wherever he lived, most likely, on account of his great height and his slew of eccentricities. But in sleepy, unassuming Znoimo, he was practically a figure of legend. He wore the same woolen overcoat all the year round and was known to describe it as, quote, a musical instrument for no reason the townsfolk could discern. His iron gray beard, which, in spite of his ardent Catholicism, demands to be described as Talmudic, was a thing of wonder to the local children, who tagged after him at a respectful distance, waiting for the instant when he'd stop short, glance back at them darkly, and mutter a rumbling, "Saint Augustine protect you, little foxes," before passing out the caramel drops he carried in his pockets. A key ingredient in Ottokar's celebrity was his extravagant sweet tooth and his claim, always made with the greatest solemnity, that he'd never eaten a pickle in his life. Oddities notwithstanding, my great-grandfather was a gentleman of what was even then referred to as the old school, equally devoted to his family, his mistress, and his Kaiser. In spite of his matter-of-fact embrace of the newest pickling and storage technologies, his distrust of what he referred to as newfangledhood, and especially of its totem animal, the horseless carriage, was his overriding passion. He was fond of taking strolls in the evenings, usually in the company of his wife and two sons, and returning the greetings of his neighbors with a dignified tip of his Homburg. On those still infrequent occasions when a motor car passed, he never failed to step squarely into its wake, oblivious to the dust devils whirling around him, and bellow, "Combust!" in the voice of Jehovah. This is actually based on my great-grandfather, who, in fact, apparently did this. The fact that combustion was the very thing that made motor cars possible was an irony no one was brave enough to call to his attention. Ottokar was a man well aware of his place in the world, a man who took his influence for granted, no differently than his cherished Kaiser did. Unbeknownst to my great-grandfather, however, both he and his Kaiser were approaching the end of their terms. According to the testimony of the last person known to have spoken with him before the accident, Ottokar was in a state of almost saintly exaltation in his final hours. The witness in question was one Marta Svoboda, the knurtle-faced spouse of the town's leading butcher, with whom my great-grandfather had maintained a clandestine friendship since the middle of his 22nd year. A specialty of Svoboda's shop was Fenchelwurst, pork sausage with fennel, and Ottokar was in the habit of calling on her each weekday at 12:15, just after the shop had closed for midday, to pick up the tidy wax paper package tied with red butcher's twine that was awaiting him there like an anniversary present. Where the man of the house spent his lunch hour, I have no idea. Perhaps he had a Valentinka of his own. For the whole of his adult duration, my great-grandfather's days followed an inflexible schedule, divided with perfect symmetry between mornings in his laboratory and afternoons devoted to the gherkin trade. The intervening hour, however, was reserved for a game of Tarok with his kleine Martelein, who was, to judge by the only photograph I've seen, anything but klein, but whose fennel sausage, coincidentally or not, was reputedly the manna of the gods. My great-grandfather showed up earlier than usual on that cataclysmic morning, dabbing at his forehead, although it was perfectly dry, with a filthy gray rag from his workshop. Marta bustled him at once to the enormous settee in her bedroom and insisted he remove his shoes and his socks. Ottokar indulged her good-naturedly, protesting that he was in excellent health, that he'd never felt more vigorous, but allowing her to have her way, as always. It's an odd thing. Although the thought of my parents' lovemaking turns my stomach, I don't feel the slightest resistance to picturing my great-grandfather and his mistress fornicating like love-struck bonobos. On this particular day, given his condition, I imagine the butcher's wife straddling him like a cyclist, leaving her apron on in case of interruption, her ample body driving his hips into the upholstery and causing the French enamel of the settee's frame to crack like the shell of an overboiled egg. These were his last earthly moments, and I like to think he made the most of them. At some point, Ottokar dug his left hand into a pocket of his coat, pulled out some, but not all, this is very important, of the hastily scribbled notes he'd made while sitting on his workbench and arranged them in a row across the table. He confessed to feeling slightly feverish and allowed Frau Svoboda to apply a compress to his brow. At 1:05, with the freakishly precise awareness of the hour that has always distinguished the men of my family, he sat up and announced that he had to be off. He seemed refreshed by the respite, and his forehead felt cooler, but his eyes shone with a fervor that took Marta quite aback. She made no attempt to stop him when he teetered to his feet and left the house. It was just past 1300 hours CET, the hour of rest in every cranny of that narcoleptic empire, and by all accounts, a muggy afternoon. By the time the clock on the Radichny Tower struck 1:15, Ottokar was crossing Obrakova Street with his hands clasped behind him, taking long, abstracted steps, staring down at the freshly cobbled street and nodding to himself in quiet triumph. At the same instant, Hildebrand Bachling, a dealer in jewelry and pocket watches from Vienna, was making a leisurely circuit of the town square, affording the public as much time as possible to admire his 15-horsepower Daimler. The precise sequence of events is impossible to reconstruct, though 6 members of my family have tried. Most likely Herr Bachling was momentarily distracted by the smile of a Fräulein, by the smell of fresh hops, and failed to notice the man drifting into his course. Wealth is famously insecure, and even the greatest art is shackled to its culture and its age. A scientific breakthrough, by contrast, is timeless. A great theory can be amended, like Galileo's planetary system, improved on, like Darwin's principle of natural selection, even ultimately discarded, like Newton's postulation of absolute time. Once it's been metabolized, however, once it's been passed through the collective intestines and added to the socio-conceptual chain, it can vanish only with the death of human knowledge. My great-grandfather had just made a discovery that promised to bring him not merely fortune and fame, and even in some quarters, infamy, but immortality. This intoxicating fact must have colored his thoughts as he made his way homeward, reviewing that morning's calculations like a magpie sorting bits of bottle glass. He barely recognized his neighbors, returned nobody's greeting, perceived nothing but the cobbles at his feet. The clatter of the Daimler's engine was thoroughly drowned out by the buzzing of his brain. What happened next was attested to by everybody on the square that day. Bachling took sudden notice of the man in his path. He popped up out of nowhere, he said at his deposition, out of the air itself, and clawed frantically at the Daimler's manual brake. Ottokar paid no mind to his impending end until its grill made gentle contact with his paunch. His coat seemed to drape itself over the hood of the Daimler as if no human body were inside it, and by the time he hit the cobbles, he was in his shirt sleeves. Bachling opened his mouth in a coquettish O of disbelief, extending his right arm over the windshield in an absurd attempt to shunt aside his victim. A stack of loose papers pirouetted skyward with no more urgency or fuss than the Daimler took to pass over the obstruction. The papers came to rest in the middle of the street, in perfect order, as I picture it. But no one present took the slightest notice. Whenever I try to imagine my great-grandfather in those ultimate instances of, his earthly duration, what comes to me instead is a poem that his grandson, my father, used to whisper to me when I was still a child. I saw eternity the other night, like a great ring of pure and endless light, all calm as it was bright, and round beneath it, time in hours, days, years, driven by the spheres, like a vast shadow moved, in which the world and all her train were hurled. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Those were beautiful readings and so much to dive into. I think it's also very interesting that sort of the quest of the Talavars to find these sort of Wordsworthian spots of time that are extra chronological, that are sort of outside, and these charmed moments. Your characters found those too. James and Marilyn had that Thanksgiving dinner with the bronze turkey coming out of the oven, and love has sort of transported them out of the narrative of their lives, and they have that moment that they can remember and hang on to in the same way that love allowed the Ottokar and his butcher's wife mistress to have that charmed sexual moment. Anyway, that just sort of leapt out to me as you were both reading.
And Celeste makes a wonderful use of detail when you're writing and you want to slow down the story and you kind of want to, if not stop time, then slow it down. A wonderful way to do that, which you did beautifully, is just to describe the details, you know, the details of the cooking and of their being together in that scene.
Not to make it too much of a love fest, I was thinking that when you were...
I was trying to make it a love fest.
We really just met earlier today. but I was thinking, you know, the way that you write is so filmic, which I mean as a compliment, and I think a lot of that is because of the way that you use the images, you know, from this, you know, this couple making love on the couch and the crackling of the varnish. In imagining it, it plays out almost in slow motion. It's sort of like a slow motion scene. You see the car slowly moving along, and the man is slowly coming this way, and the car moves a little bit more, and he moves a little closer, and they're getting sort of closer. And then even at the moment of impact, you know, I really admire the way that you sort of slow that moment down, because it clearly is going to be something so pivotal to this, this family.
I also just thought it would be funny for someone to be hit by a car in extreme slow motion. Because in the story, the car really is going about 3 miles an hour. He's just slow. Which didn't happen to my great-grandfather. He lived to a ripe old age.
That was my next question. But another thing is, both of those excerpts showed how fluidly you shift perspective. So you started with Marilyn, and then it goes into James remembering his upbringing. And I mean, this one, it's all sort of the story of Ottokar, but this is being told by his great-great-grandson. And throughout the book, you're sort of going around to different speakers and characters and sort of zeroing in on them. And I'm wondering, like, in these books where there's not one main character, there's sort of familial sagas and there's sort of constellations of people, how do you distribute your authorial empathy and attention, and like, how do you decide which characters to bring forth and which to sort of recede away from?
I think that's that balancing act is why this book took me so long to finish. In a lot of ways, I was kind of struck, John, in the passage that you were reading, in the way that you, and I say this admiringly, cheat by saying that the main character says, well, I'm kind of imagining this, and that, you know, the fact that he's admitted that makes us go, okay, fine, we're willing to go there. And then he can imagine into everybody's mind, which I think is fabulous. Because one of the problems of having a narrator who moves from place to place is that sometimes your reader doesn't come with you. And your reader goes, no, I wanna stay with this person and I wanna find out what's going on with them. And you as the author have to kind of guide your reader's attention. And so for me, striking that balance was sort of difficult. And I think what I ended up doing was kind of making an even distribution of it. But I think one thing that maybe sort of ties all of this together is that in a sense, by not having one central character, one thing that does is it kind of suggests to the reader, it's not this one person's story, it's not that one person's story. It's sort of the story about how all of these people are going to fit together into a family saga or a family tragedy, how they're all working together. And it sort of diffuses your attention so that you're looking at a big picture. I don't know if you agree with that.
No, I think that's true, yeah. I mean, anytime you're writing a book about a family, of course, you're going to be shifting your focus, and you know, at different stages in the book, different characters will sort of take center stage. And in a way, you already know how they all relate to one another because you have the sort of given structure of the family. But of course, far more interesting is the way that they actually are really relating to one another. You know, they may be, you know, mother and son or brother and sister, but maybe their relationship is more like one of, you know, office manager and temp or something, you know, whatever it could be. Those little surprises in of the actual way that people relate to one another and where the actual power lies is, of course, often very surprising. And, you know, like in the scene that you were just, that you read, the fact that she takes the initiative to kiss him initially and that she's, in a way, the aggressor at the beginning of their connection, you know, that's one of those pleasant surprises that also lend reality to the story too, you know, because there are bad surprises that seem implausible, but then there are the surprises that really resonate and make you kind of really believe that you're in a real place, in a real world with real people.
And I think that's it, is sort of the surprises that in some ways make you feel that these are actual people rather than just characters, that they're not the things that the writer put in because they seem like they would be exciting, but because in some ways they were speaking to the story that was coming out of them.
Yeah. Although, I mean, it's interesting too, because I think that both of your books, all two that we've talked about tonight and everything that I never told you. It's about sort of the mystery of character and like how people are mysterious to each other, but what will a person do? What won't a person do? But I wonder if any of that carries over as an author. Like, how well do you know what your characters are going to do? Does that sense of like the fundamental unknowability and mysteriousness of a human person sort of affect the way you think about your characters?
I like this question because sometimes people will ask me, well, what happens after the book ends? Or what happens about this? And I think there's like an idea that writers, because we made up these people, know everything about them. So like, you know, I theoretically would be able to tell you what, you know, the father's favorite candy was or what color socks this person was wearing. And are you that kind of writer? Do you know what color socks? Fostered.
There are a lot of writers who will boast about this kind of thing.
I think they're lying.
And they'll say, oh, I know what toppings they'd order on their pizza.
Yeah.
You know, they may be talking about a character in, you know, ancient Rome, but they'll claim that they could.
Right. If he were to order a pizza.
Yeah.
It would, but do you?
Maybe they had pizza in ancient Rome. I don't know.
Maybe we just didn't find it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. So I don't tend to write that way. I know more about the characters than I think is on the page, but I don't think that I know all of them. And so maybe to go to your question, it does. There is, you know, a certain unknowability about them. I mean, I think about, you know, friends that I've known for 20 odd years, or my sister who's known me my whole life, and then periodically we still surprise each other. Well, she'll go, I didn't know that you liked this, and I'm like, I didn't know that you wouldn't eat broccoli. You know, things that you would think you would know, but they're not, they don't seem fundamental, but that kind of shakes your idea about how well you know that person. So for me, for the characters, I feel like there are things about them that I don't know, and they're not important things. They're like those broccoli things, or they're like the pizza toppings, but I don't know, how do you create your characters?
I think it depends a little bit on the book. You know, it varies from book to book. My very first book, the way that I managed to, it was a very intimidating idea to try to start to write a book. But I think at some point I just, that first book started with four characters who weren't necessarily fully developed in my mind, but I knew what their relationships were to one another. I didn't know what they were going to order on their pizza, but I did know what they wanted from one another, or what the sources of conflict might be. And I just kind of thought, well, if I just let them interact with each other, you know, maybe something book length will come out of that. But I think there are some writers who really approach, and they'll even talk about being sad to leave the characters they've invented in a book, and other writers who really think about, they think of the whole book as a system or as a machine that they're building, or a world that they're creating, in which there are these very elaborate moving parts that, you know, hopefully will create the illusion of life. But who was I was talking to someone recently, they pointed out that Don DeLillo was such a writer. This person argued that Don DeLillo probably didn't even view his characters as characters, but they each fulfilled an important function in the kind of system he was creating. I don't know whether that's true for him or not. I think there's a range of approaches. I'm not personally necessarily the pizza topping type of writer. Maybe, I don't know, maybe
have
I will
Have you
be.
Ever eaten a pickle? Is my
Have I ever eaten a pickle?
Food related.
I love pickles.
Okay.
I love pickles so much. I'm the person who takes the pickles off everybody else's plate if you're getting hamburgers.
Other people don't eat their pickles, and so I'm also a pickle
stealer.
I just feel they're
like
going to waste.
It's such a boon. It's such a landfall. It's such a windfall, rather. You just, you know, you're at a picnic, and everyone has a pickle on their plate.
And nobody else is going to eat them. So.
I mean, you know, that's a meal right there.
I'm sorry, what are we talking about?
This is all very... we were talking about the difference between sort of seeing your work as a contraption. And I'm thinking of like Ezra Pound, who said a poem is like a machine that works. And so I guess there's some cross-genre continuity there. But,
Very beautiful books can be written,
yeah.
Sort of from outside in that way. Or it's a sort of clockmaker school of writing, and probably books that one wouldn't necessarily recognize. I don't know if you can look at books and recognize the approach.
But I think that even, you know, in writing workshops, when sort of writers read each other's work, there's always this question of, is this working? Meaning sort of, are all the gears meshing with each other? Are there some extra parts that you're not using? And I think that also may be related to the question that we're talking about, you know, like, does this serve a function, or is it just here because I really wanted to write a scene about, you know, making a Thanksgiving dinner? You know, is it doing something for the story or not? I think that's sort of, for me, the filter.
That can be very important. That can be the scaffolding that you've kind of built around. You've put up the scaffolding around this house you're trying to build. Eventually, maybe a good editor or a friend or someone who's reading the book will say, you know, this scene here seems inessential, or, you know, maybe you're just, it's just you did this research, so you want to include it. Mm-hmm. And eventually you can cut that stuff away.
Yeah.
But it was kind of necessary to making the book, even if you don't want necessarily keep it in the
end. And then hopefully when you cut it away, your house is still standing, right?
I think writing is not just a question of, you know, you do all this writing, and some of it's bad, and some of it's good, and then you cut away what's bad, you keep the good, and you're all set. You're teaching yourself how to write the book you're writing as you go.
And you're also, I think, you're teaching yourself what the book is. A lot of times, I think, you know, there is an idea, and it may or may not be the right idea, but you are sort of in the process of writing things, learning, like, well, this was a bad area, let's move back over here, that you are figuring out in some ways sort of what it is, what that you're writing about.
When you talk about, like, what a book is, do you feel like your books need to have arguments, like essential philosophical propositions that they are advancing? And it's not like you just use your decoder ring and, like, this is, you know, what the book is about. It's asking this question. But, I mean, there is sort of a sense that some books have this sort of deep vein of a theme, and that is what the book is about. And if you stopped the book on the street and grabbed it by the lapel and said, what's your point of view? It was like, okay, this is my point of view. And I wonder if you feel that books need to have that strong sense of argument or point of view, or if they can just sort of exist and radiate questions.
Well, I knew that my theme was pickles from the very beginning.
Well, both John and I earlier today spent some time talking to students in different high schools, and one of the things that I found was that they were really interested in kind of that decoder ring aspect of it. I mean, they really wanted to know what I meant, and I think that's exactly right for being in high school, that you're trained to think that way. You know, they're like, well, okay, you have a lot of eggs in your book, which was not something that I had noticed myself. I said, I do, and they started listing all of the eggs that I had in the book, and I had to admit that I did have a lot of eggs. And then they said, you know, what did you mean by that? And I really felt like I was kind of letting them down, where I said, honestly, I didn't realize that I had that many eggs in there, and maybe I need some therapy. But I think that after we talked about it for a while, I said, you know, there's a certain point at which the book starts to help you out. I don't know if you find this, because you have done this much more than I have, but at a certain point, the book starts to almost have a sense of what you're supposed to be doing or what it's supposed to be, and it starts pointing you in different directions. You know, so maybe by the time I had a hard-boiled egg and then I had a cookbook talking about eggs, the book started to go, an egg would fit really well in this scene. And I would go, oh, yes, an egg would fit well in the scene, and then there was another egg. And at a certain point, I think those things which were in there for who knows what reason, because my subconscious was thinking about eggs, or because I like eggs, or whatever it was, you know, or if you go into a Jungian thing, because eggs symbolize X, Y, and Z, for whatever reason they got in there, in the world of the book, they start to take on a meaning, like you start to give it a meaning. And so, to go to your question about theme, I don't know if a book needs to have one, but I think that most of the time, by the time you're finished with it, hopefully it has developed some kind of meaning. Whether that's the same thing as theme, I don't know. But I don't know that it starts out that way, but I think maybe towards the end, for the reader to have a satisfying experience, they need to be able to take something from it.
Yeah, I think very few fiction writers would say that they start out a given project with a specific argument or a theme in mind.
I think it's almost always a bad direction to go in.
Yeah, I mean, because the danger, of course, is that you, rather than creating a kind of self-sustaining little universe of your own invention, you essentially create a polemic instead. You know, it becomes a diatribe. I mean, I'm writing a book right now that's set in Afghanistan and Pakistan, sort of during the sort of drone wars that were happening there. And I think that drones are dreadful things that have made the world a terrible place and will continue to do so. But I can't think that that's why I'm writing this book, because it's not why I'm writing the book. You know, I mean, if you really want to make an argument in that way, then you need to write an op-ed piece for the Times or something.
Right, then fiction is not the right medium. And likely, I imagine that your viewpoint will carry through the book, but it's not maybe the motivating force of the book.
Yeah, I often think of it as when you're starting out with the beginning of the first draft of a book, it's sort of like you're feeding some kind of film into a projector, but it's very blurry, it's completely out of focus. And every day that you spend working towards the end of that first draft, you're slowly adjusting the focus, and it probably only becomes perfectly into focus when you finish the last sentence of that draft. Then you know, and then you can go back and start revising with that knowledge, but you can't start with the knowledge or else you'll do something that's predictable or one-sided.
I like that analogy. I always think of it as, like, I have a destination in mind, roughly. Like, I want to go over that way. And I start going, and then I find that my path doesn't lead that way. And you take all sorts of wrong turns, and eventually when you figure out where you were going, you can then draw a straighter path than you drew the first time. But if you set off sort of driving in that direction, that I feel like a lot of the energy goes out of the project.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, it does help to have a general sense of where you want to end up, I think, you know, even if you don't truly ultimately end up there.
But I think it's really important also for the writer to have questions. And so in some ways, rather than thinking about a thesis statement, it's more about having an area of interest or things that you kind of want to talk about, like a subject matter that you can dig into. Because I think that it's in the questioning that the story actually comes out. And that's often, I think, if we already knew what we were writing, I think that the desire to write it would be greatly lessened. Mm-hmm. If you sort of knew exactly what you wanted to do and all you had to do was transcribe, I don't think most people would write that down.
Yeah, no, questions are very good, I think, to have.
Do you find that you learned things from your books? Not only narrowly about the specific characters and their milieu, but in general, did your books teach you things that you didn't know?
I think you learn things about yourself, certainly. Unless you're talking about the research that one does in the course of writing, of course, that's very educational, you know. I mean, you learn a lot that way. But you do learn things about yourself over time, you know, because it's not always a fun thing to do, and you're struggling against walking away from it all the time, at least I am. And what makes you stick with a given project is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I'd agree with that I think, you know, you learn something about yourself. I feel like in writing this book, I learned how to tell this story, and I don't know that that's going to be applicable to the next book. I'm kind of hoping it will be. But I learned something about the way that my brain works, which is a weird way, that it sticks things together and it finds connections between things that maybe other people would not see. So there's something, I feel like in some ways this sounds very navel-gazing, and I guess it kind of is, to write a book and then hope that people will want to read it. But something about the way that, you know, I make sense of the world, which may or may not match up with other people's way of making sense of the world. We didn't answer your question.
No, you totally did. That's beautiful. Thank you. And I hope that you will all soon have the experience, if you haven't already, of learning more about yourselves and about these authors by reading their books. And on that note, I'd love to just take a few questions from the audience, if you guys wouldn't mind answering a few more questions. So if people just want to raise their hands. Sure, hi.
This is for Celeste.
Sorry, I'm doing this so that I can see you.
Okay, I'll do that too.
Okay, well now I can't see you.
you talk a little bit about the changing perspectives of the character, which is really one of the things that I found very striking, very interesting about it. What I was curious about is, did that happen by design, or did it happen by the way your mind just flipped into the next character?
By my weird mind. So the question is about sort of the change of perspectives in the novel, and whether that was something that I sort of consciously designed, or whether that was sort of the way my brain worked. I guess the answer is both. It's the book started off where each character would have a little section, and you would spend, you know, a little part of the day with that character, and then you'd move to the next character, and you'd only have access to their thoughts and their points of view. And the book continued like that through several drafts, and I realized that this was a problem, because there was a logistical problem. Part of it was that if I wanted to show an argument between two characters, for the reader to know what both characters were thinking, you had to watch the argument twice. You had to watch it from the mother's point of view, and then go and watch the same argument again from the father's point of view, and nobody should have to do that. But there was also sort of, I think, a larger issue, which is that what I realized I was interested in, so maybe I can answer your question now. What I realized I was interested in was sort of the things that we know that nobody else knows, and sort of all the information that's sort of outside of the characters that they're not sharing with each other. So in the scene that I read, we get to know all the things that Marilyn is thinking, and then she tells James this very small bit. And James, we get to learn a lot about James's background and about, you know, sort of various feelings he has about his family and his family makeup and all these things. And then he tells Marilyn just this one little bit, that his parents are dead. And I realized that part of the subject I was actually wrestling with was all of the things that they didn't say. And in order to give that to the audience, I needed to move between consciousnesses. I needed sort of an omniscient narrator who could do that. So I think my brain was pushing me in that direction. And then I sat down to write the last draft. And my very patient agent said, okay, what are you gonna do? And I said, okay, I'm gonna rewrite the entire book in a different point of view. And because she's lovely and I guess also had faith in me, she said, okay, you do that. And then come back when you have a draft. And I did it, and she went, I don't know how. The first thing she said when we talked on the phone was, I don't know how you did that, but you did it. And I think that was part of my brain pushing me in the weird direction. So the answer is both.
Others. And eggs. The and answer eggs. Is also eggs.
Eggs are the answer to everything, apparently.
Yes.
So at what point in the initial draft does it become something that...
That you're aware of, the pacing of the novel.
Did everybody hear that? Could everyone hear that? The question of pacing and when that becomes... I think that, you know, when you're writing the first draft of something, or when I'm writing the first draft of something, in my case, one of the things that's driving me forward is this anxiety. Will I ever finish? Will I lose the thread? Will I kind of forget what's good about this idea that I have or about this type of book I want to write? So there are a lot of things that... There's a lot of pressure just to keep going, you know, just get it down. At least that's the way I work. And then I think, you know, don't even worry so much about if what you're writing is good from your point of view. It just, you can work on it later. You know you're going to revise it, you know, 6, 7, 8, 12 times. So I try to free myself from too many of those questions. But as I've gotten older and as I've, you know, I've now done this 4 times or 5 times given what I'm working on now, I'm a little bit more relaxed about things. So I'm not so worried the way I used to be when I was starting out that I was just going to forget what I wanted to do the next day or the next week, or that I would lose whatever I thought was good about what I was doing. So I've become more able to kind of be a little bit more self-aware as I'm writing and think, you know, this might, maybe we should speed things up a little bit here, or, you know, I'll save myself some time 2 years from now if I maybe address these issues, you know, immediately rather than putting them off. Pacing is a hugely important thing, of course. I was once fortunate enough to have a series of days in which I interviewed the Japanese writer Haruki Murakami when I was quite young and starting out as a writer. And, you know, what he does and what I do are generally very different, but he told me some very interesting things. He told me about how he loved to read Tolstoy, and in particular War and Peace, and how one of the things that War and Peace taught him was when to be fast and when to be slow, and that the more, as I was saying earlier, the more detail you use, the more the more carefully you describe a given scene, and he in this case was talking about a given battle scene, I think, in War and Peace, the slower things become. And by your decision as a writer of how much information to give to the reader, you're controlling the speed of the whole train in a way. And I'd never thought about that before. It's only one way that you can affect pacing as a writer, but...
It's a very potent way. I've just finished recently reading a book that came out called Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff. And there are sections, so it's the story of a marriage that lasts, I think, 24 years. And so there are certain sections where in the space of a paragraph, she'll skip over about 2 years. And she does this by going, okay, then this, then Christmas came with its glistening bells and rain and snow and then a slushy January, and all of a sudden it's a year later. And so there is a pacing thing. I'm thinking, because we were talking before, John, about how you're a musician, if you feel like your experience as a musician at all sort of influences how you think about tempo of a book.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I was always a very bad musician, and the bands that I played in had... They were pretty mediocre, so...
Well, as we talked earlier, you were not the drummer, right? Where no, the drummer is the one who sets the tempo.
Yeah, I always wanted to be the drummer, but... I'm not sure. I'm also not sure that I necessarily have figured pacing out perfectly, you know? I think there are times when I wonder whether, because that's when you're really thinking about the potential reader of your writing too, you know, is this going to be too slow is it going to be too fast for the reader and kind of be bewildering? You know, the book that I read from tonight covers a century, so I had to do a lot of that stuff that Lauren does in Fates and Furies of, you know, for example, my book, there are certain kind of global upheavals and crises that the book addresses and deals with when they are relevant to the story and to the family. But for example, I think I cover the Vietnam War in about a paragraph, you know, or even less, because it just wasn't something that needed to be talked about. So sometimes it goes very fast and then gets very slow again, you know, hopefully in an amusing way.
Well, I'm worried that we're not in a charmed extra chronological space and that we might not be able to take any more questions, but you think we could take one more or two more? Let's take one more question. Yes.
Hi. This question is for Celeste. I am a former Grove Street student, so excited to be here. So with that in mind, I'm trying to work on the first draft of the novel, and so I've been looking to books that I admire, which includes yours. So I have a craft question for you. Is there anything that you are really excited about that you feel like you did really well in this novel that you would, you know, recommend or...
Oh, so just that little question. One of the things that I struggled with in the novel, I'll come at it that way because I think that's easier for me than saying the things that I'm like proud of in the novel. One of the things that I really struggled with was the structure. So if you've read the novel, you know that there are sort of two timelines and they twist together. And I didn't know how to do that, and I tried all kinds of crazy things. And at the time, I had a really long bulletin board that went all the way across my office, and I had this crazy index card system set up with string, and they were color-coded, and it was connecting them, and it looked like a crazy person's room. And what I ended up doing that I think actually helped, and so this is more generally applicable to any project, I think, is that I looked at books that I thought were doing that really well, and I sat down to really kind of analyze them and dissect them. So I looked at books, a book called The Goddess Small Things by Arundhati Roy, which is a book that I love, which also moves back and forth between time periods. And I sat down and I kind of mapped it out. Like I literally was like, chapter one covers these scenes, it has these characters, here's the date. Chapter two, it does this. And then I, you know, kind of looked at that, and I looked at a number of other books like that, and I tried to figure out how they did it. And I think that that's one of the best things that you can do overall is if you have an idea of what you might want to do, it seems kind of cruel to say like, well, sit down and just kind of dissect the book. Just cut it into pieces and then see how it was put together. But in a lot of ways, it's such a useful way to do it. It's sort of like dressmakers often when they want to know how something was made, they pick it apart at the seams and they see how the pieces were cut and then they put them back together. I think that if you have an idea or whatever you're struggling with whether it's how to build characters or how to structure your book or how to slow down or speed up in time. If you find a book that you think does that really well, you can learn a lot by taking even just a small section of it and really analyzing it. I mean, I think that's how I learn, and I think that's the best sort of advice that I always have for writers is just copy, basically, find things that you like and then
and don't be afraid
feel
that it
blatantly.
Won't be you anymore.
No, because it's going to be.
Yeah.
It's going to come through the filter of you, so copy.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much for coming.